Hello, and welcome to the Psych in Business podcast, where we highlight the integration of psychology and psychological principles into the world of business and organizations. I'm your host, Dr. Ernest Wade. All right, I'm really excited to introduce our guest today. She's a clinical organizational psychologist, and her name is Dr. Kayla Lalleux-Labarge. And Kayla, I hope I said that right.
Perfect.
Kayla applies her unique set of interdisciplinary skills to workplace dynamics and has delivered several seminars centered on professional authenticity, and I really want to dive into that later, and creating positive, personal-centered environments that thrive. Kayla also works at the intersection of technology and psychology to create products that help parents, educators, and children thrive and flourish. And anyone who knows me knows that I live at the intersection of psychology and technology, so we'll definitely dig into that as well. Kayla, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Kayla, I'm so glad that you're here, and I really want to dig into these things, but I always want to start by asking, you know, tell us a little bit about your story. How did you go from clinical to organization to working in business with leaders and teams?
That's a really great question. You know, I think my journey really starts in high school. It probably started before that, but I think my professional journey really started to become clear in high school, where I took my first psychology class and I knew right away, oh my gosh, this is what I'm meant to be. And I'm really grateful for that, because, you know, in some of my work, I'm working with people to kind of try to figure that out, mm-hmm. where they belong professionally. So I was really grateful to kind of be in that class and really be lit up inside by the topics of human behavior, psychological change, the treatment and intervention around these things. Mm-hmm. So from that point on, I graduated with my bachelor's of science in psychology. I went on to get a master's in science and clinical psychology, and then went the traditional route through the PsyD program at Georgia Southern University, which is an APA accredited program. My program here primarily focused on traditional therapy modalities, mm-hmm. so very much training clinical psychologists who wanted to specialize in mental health treatment, less so specializing in the areas of organizational or consulting psychology, mm-hmm. Even less focus at the time on the intersection of psychology and technology, which more recently, as you know, Ernest, has bloomed and blossomed in a really nice way. So while I was at Georgia Southern, I kind of started to sense that, you know, maybe the traditional avenue of just being a therapist, it didn't quite feel right to me. Mm-hmm. There felt like I had this interest in systems thinking. Yeah. I had this interest in how to make an impact on a larger group, a larger organization. And these things kind of drove me to create consultation opportunities where I was kind of for free offering any company, any team, my time to just kind of gain experience working in this space. Fast forward to my internship. I moved here to Philly. I did my residency at Temple at Tuttleman Counseling Services. And again, while there, I found more opportunities to engage this kind of intersection of clinical and organizational psychology. Mm-hmm. And for me, what that meant was looking at the counseling center at the time as a system, as an organization that could be improved. I remember I was really kind of blown away by the fact that at one point in the semester while I was there, the wait time to see a therapist got to 11 weeks. Hmm. I just want to pause and say that again.
Yeah.
The wait time to see a therapist at a college counseling center got to 11 weeks. And I was like, no. Yeah. We can't have this. We need an intervention on the system. And they were like, do it. Give us an intervention on the system. And so I did. We looked at the way we were providing individual and group therapies and basically developed skills-based groups that students could drop in at any time. Mm-hmm. So treatment, the wait for treatment went from 11 weeks to a day.
Wow.
Through this solution. And actually, this is something that has been implemented now across university counseling centers across the nation. From a little intern doing a organizational consultation on the center. And so I think that experience really affirmed the direction I was going in, seeking more clinical organizational opportunities. And that led me to Dr. Nicole Lipkin, Dr. Nicole Lipkin, I'm not sure if you know about her, but she's a best-selling author in the space of leadership and organizational psychology. Mm-hmm. She was at the time the owner of one of the largest psychological group practices in Philadelphia. And I was privileged enough to do a 2-year postdoc under her, where I really got to see what a clinical organizational psychologist looks like in action. And again, further affirmed my belief that that's where I fit as a psychologist. And that really grew into this other side of what I do. You know, Ernest, I like to say that I'm a clinical organizational psychologist by day, and by night I'm a technologist. and that's because they do sometimes, at least when they first started to evolve, felt like very different worlds. Mm-hmm. Psychology had not yet stepped into the technology sector in a real way. We weren't really pioneering in any way there. And I think that's where my journey took me, was part-time. I'm still doing clinical organizational work. But my real kind of passion now is our startup, Hey Kiddo, where I take all of the expertise that a psychology has, whether it be from grant writing, research approaches, intervention approaches, and I bring those all together to build technologies for educators and parents,
yeah,
to make sure that they have the skills, they have the education, the evidence base that a psychologist had, much to the same effect as what I was trying to intervene at the college counseling center. How do we get people quickly to the information we need? How do we get people quickly to the treatment they need? And technology can be it crosses boundaries of social class. It crosses boundaries of race, gender, and it can reach a diverse group of people. So I think this next part of my career is really pioneering and being a leader in the voices of psychologists who are building ethical technology that have a true social impact, and what those look like.
Yeah, I love your story. I think that's such an interesting story, and there's so much that sticks out from it to me. I think one of the first things I want to ask you about is the systems thinking, because I think what you're highlighting here is the skill that psychologists have in being a systems thinker, right? Because normally we're thought of as people who only focus on the individual human behavior, which is true. But what you're highlighting here is the ability to focus on the system, right? That really impacts the individual. So talk to us a little bit more about that, how you really see that and perceive that and were able to impact that.
You know, we can't separate the individual from the system. The individual impacts the system and the system impacts the individual in both known and unknown ways. And I found that if we take a larger kind of fly out approach, a contextual approach to the environment, to the system, to the, we can call it a lot of different things. Workplaces call it the culture. Mm-hmm. A psychologist working in a therapeutic setting might call it the system. Mm-hmm. But really, they're getting at this thing that is larger than the individual that can both help and hinder them. And I think that's really important. That context is really important when we're thinking about making individual change.
Yeah.
Because we are only kind of emboldened enough to make the change that our system will allow us to make.
Yeah.
Even in my examples that I gave, I was only kind of emboldened to make these changes when the system kind of allowed for them. It was the right time for them. So I think it's sometimes a mistake to focus on the individual without taking into the larger context into space. And I really love that in my work. Oftentimes, I think I bring that unique perspective to workplaces to get them out of maybe thinking of problematic workplace behaviors as an individual problem and more as a culture or contextual problem that we need to look at.
I love what you're saying here, because what you're talking about is really appreciating that it's not just about internal issues, but also appreciating the environment and how the environment impacts the individual and how the individual impacts the environment. So it's that symbiotic nature of the relationship and really respecting the environment and appreciating that you can't ask people in a workplace to change or to adapt without appreciating how their environment will impact that change and how it will impact their ability to be successful. I want to ask you about something that you mentioned that we talked about, was that professional authenticity, right? Talk to us about what that means. And I'm also interested to understand how the environment, the system, the culture impacts that.
That is a really good question. And I think it's one of the things that I enjoy uncovering most, both with organizations at large and with individuals. Mm-hmm. So to me, professional authenticity is this idea of self-leadership, this idea that if we are aware of our own strengths, aware of our shortcomings, aware of how to leverage social dynamics at work, how we do that uniquely. Because again, how Kayla moves through a social environment is going to look different from how Ernest moves through a social environment. And I think in the past, we've kind of created what I'm going to call these leadership archetypes, mm-hmm. where a leader looked, felt a certain way. You know, when I think back 50 years at the literature on leadership, for example, we think that more authoritative leadership styles, authoritarian leadership styles were preferred. Leadership styles that were directive, mm-hmm. Less collaborative, more hierarchical leadership kind of systems. And I think we're moving away from that in the literature, where work and leadership is becoming a little bit more humble, a little bit more collaborative, mm-hmm. a little bit more systems
yeah.
focused. And I think professional authenticity, whether it be at the cultural level of the organization or at the individual level, is something really important to look at. So at the individual level, I'm defining that, like I said, Ernest, as knowing your individual strengths, weaknesses, how to leverage and move forward in your social environment successfully. Mm-hmm. Mostly I take a mindfulness-based strengths perspective to that. I'm really interested in having my clients really understand their strengths, mm-hmm. understand how they overuse and underuse those at work, so we can kind of create a balance mm-hmm. that gets mm-hmm. them functioning at their optimal level. I think from a cultural perspective at work, authenticity looks like the organization is in tune with its behavioral indicators. Mm-hmm. It's in tune with its cultural indicators. It can name them. They share a language for if the culture is performance-based, mm-hmm. if the culture is one of caring, if the culture is pragmatic. These are just a few words. Yeah. None of them are right or wrong. But that there is an authenticity in the culture that they know, they understand these, they know where they limit them, they know how to leverage them. Mm-hmm. And so it allows us to kind of, everyone to kind of show up in their own way and still be successful at work under, whether it be the cultural system or their own individual system.
So Kayla, help me understand how you apply this in the workplace setting, because I think as we've talked about, the environment plays a role, right? And so I've had a lot of times where you're trying to work with the leader to be authentic and to, you know, understand and appreciate their leadership style, but the culture, the environment doesn't always support that. So do you have any examples of how you've worked through this with the individual and the culture, the organization as a whole?
Yeah. So, you know, I like to start at understanding the, like I said, the cultural system, because it will create confines, barriers, boundaries around the expectations of work. Mm-hmm. And every workplace looks different, and every workplace has a different culture that it thrives yeah. off of. So for me, I'd start off probably with using tools that get at naming these things, because oftentimes organizations want to have a culture, but they've never put in any of the work mm-hmm. to build the culture or even identify what type of culture they want to have. So let's start yes. at square one. Mm-hmm. Square one is identifying the words that describe the culture, the words that describe the authentic culture, yeah. not the culture that we think is the archetype for success, that actual company's authentic culture. Yeah.
So creating that common language that everyone can use and understand.
And not only a common language that we can use and understand, but that we can then behaviorize, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? When I have one company I work with, and the caring is the number one cultural indicator. You know, when I think of what caring means for them and what caring could mean for someone else is totally different. Yeah. So helping them behaviorize that caring, even where we're saying caring is defined by having respectful relationships with your coworkers. Mm-hmm. Caring is defined as giving feedback, even when the feedback is tough to give. And that way, when we start to talk about professional authenticity at work with individuals, we can use these cultural behavioral indicators to say, okay, when we define caring, mm-hmm. this is what they define it as. How do you define it? And oftentimes we'll find a lot of overlap in that people, once they know how the culture is defining it, there's overlap in how they're defining it. And so I would then work with them to, again, show up under those indicators. And maybe caring isn't one of their values. Maybe it's something else completely. Maybe it's accountability. And part of what we have to do is frame, how does accountability fit in with caring?
Right.
How do we frame that so you can show up every day and be your best authentic self at work while also operating within the expectations of the cultural mm-hmm, system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that you just said that, because I think it's really important when we're talking about authenticity also to respect the cultural boundaries that you're working within, right? So it's not like that you show up to work and I remember this example someone gave me and says, I'm just a loud person and that's just how I am. That's my authentic self. And yet the workplace required them to be less so. And so try to understand, okay, you can still be yourself, but maintaining the respect for the professional boundaries that you're in.
Exactly. And I think, you know, sometimes, again, this all or nothing thinking with at the individual level mm-hmm. or all or nothing thinking at the cultural level can really be an inhibitor to change. Because oftentimes when we're doing all or nothing thinking, there's already a defense in play there. And we have to get out of that and understand, what do you actually mean when you say you're a loud person? What authentic part of yourself are you talking about? And they might say something like, well, I'm expressive. Well, that's different from being a loud person, all or nothing. Mm-hmm. I'm expressive. And I'm able to balance my expressiveness with right place, right time thinking, yes. mindfulness, self-regulation skills. So this is how we behaviorize. Again, if you're saying you want to show up to work and be authentically expressive, and the culture says, we want you to be expressive, and it's a dialectic, work within the confines of a humble culture, for example, then we have to work again with the individual to say, okay, what does humble expressiveness look like mm-hmm. then?
Yeah.
And how can we start to bring our authentic expressive self into the authentic culture too?
Yeah, you know, I so appreciate that what you're talking about really requires you to start with self-awareness, right? At the individual level and at the organizational cultural system level, people really need to understand more about who you are as an individual, who you are as an organization, and really understand your values.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the only way we can really find authenticity, whether it be at the larger level or not. You know, I'm a big fan of Brené Brown. I think she is one of our field's most brilliant writers on what authenticity can actually look and function like, whether it be in your personal life mm-hmm. or like in Dare to Lead, where she writes about how we can be vulnerable and authentic as leaders. And so I really take that kind of message to heart. And I want to make sure it is with all its vulnerability, with all the authenticity, which sometimes people can feel like is the soft side mm-hmm. of psychology, that we're understanding that it's actually the harder side of psychology to show up and be authentic, but that we can also behaviorize that. So it plays into helping the organization through evals, mm-hmm. right? I have some organizations that use this value system to help with performance evals. They use this same kind of authentic value system to help with difficult conversations where we can depersonalize a feedback conversation by saying, hey, it wasn't you, Ernest, who just totally flopped at this. It was that you didn't meet the mark on these specific indicators. And that's very different than you're failing.
Yeah.
It is
your performance.
Yeah, it becomes a performance, a measurable performance steeped in authentic culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the way that you're separating those two out, right? It really protects the individual self-wealth and self-value, and it really focuses on the performance, the things that they do rather than who they are, right? I think it's important to separate those things out. Speaking of this, I think one of the things that I know about myself is I live at that integration of psychology and technology, right? And so I want to know more about how you balance those two. How do you bring psychology into technology, especially in this great work that you're doing at Hey Kiddo? I want to hear more about the work that you're doing there, working with parents and kids. I think that's such fantastic work that you're doing.
It's so interesting work. And if you would have asked me when I was in school, like, do psychologists build technology? I would have been like, no. Like, absolutely not. And if you would have asked me, Kayla, are you going to be one to build technology? I would have been like, no, absolutely not. but it led me here somehow. And so, you know, I think all of our skills as psychologists now, as I reflect, you know, we've been at the startup since 2017 when we got our first National Science Foundation funding. And this funding really boosted our mission that we're now funded by the taxpayers' dollars, that it is there is actually a social stake in what we're doing here. And so I bring all of my skills as a psychologist to the work. You know, I work as our director of product and research, but I started off as our director of content, where as a psychologist, I was bringing in the intervention mindset, the idea of evidence-based content and resources. I was also bringing on the research side of my background. I have several peer-reviewed publications in vast areas, from stress to anxiety to performance at work to clinical treatment interventions. And so those experiences and research really geared me up to be able to write large federal grants. I've received over $2 million in federal grant funding from grants I have led. And so those skills have really applied, in addition to formulating strong outcome research, strong product research, and what that looks like when being done by a psychologist.
Yeah.
Because it looks a little bit different done by a psychologist than a pure software engineer, for example. And I also think this kind of, to bring in the clinical organizational side, I intersect with every one of our teams, and we have a global team. And so I think my work as a clinical psychologist and understanding organizational psychologist and understanding systems
and human behavior
has allowed for there to be this outside of the product and technology, has allowed there to be this kind of larger gain of healthy operations, healthy teamwork, a close attention to team dynamics and team development, a close attention to making sure everyone can be their authentic self at work, and that
within your team, absolutely.
So putting all the stuff that I've been able to do with other organizations into practice in my own has been kind of a wonderful reciprocal learning.
Yeah, I love what the examples that you're giving here. I think for me, it's one of those things where, as psychologists, we're trained in so much, right? I think firstly, understanding human behavior, systems, research, data. I mean, all of these things, in my mind, apply really well when we're talking about technology. I mean, just technology is built by people for people. And so on both sides of that fence, psychologists can provide great expertise, and especially when we want it to be done ethically. Talk to us about how you apply that ethical principles to the work that you're doing in the technology world.
You know, I think ethics, as we see advancements, especially in AI, are going to become more and more and more important. You know, I think as a psychologist, I'm of two minds with ethics, you know, and I'm probably going to get in trouble from my ethics professors from school when I say this, but I'm of two minds of ethics, right? On the one hand, as a psychologist, right, as a clinical organizational psychologist and a psychologist building technology, I see their utility. I think they hold us to a high standard for how we're thinking about everything from assessment to data privacy to the interventions we're offering to marketing even. And I also see their limitations and that our ethics code is outdated. Our ethics code at times is more restraining than it needs to be to allow for psychologists to actually participate in technology innovation. You know, I give a lecture at my alma mater and I pull up all of the APA ethics that we have had to consider as a part of our project. And it's two slides long and it covers almost every ethical standard that we have. And we talk about the beauty of that exercise. And we also talk about how the software developer developing Facebook, the software developer developing OpenAI, they aren't pulling out the APA ethics code to check all these things. And so while I love it as a guide, it has often been confining as a technologist. And we have often had to find consultation spaces to better understand the ethics code. I think my current obsession is understanding the role in psychologists as we build what are literally neural network mimics. Mm-hmm. Like AI, open AI and these ideas of generative AI are based on the idea of neural networks at their core. This idea that we have all these different avenues and we can open them up based on the question being asked. And so how we're using the input from that, how we're restraining AI, is I think the next ethical challenge that psychologists are definitely going to have to be a part of, because we're already seeing the negative effects societally and on mental health in some cases when we allow technologies to move too fast. So again, I'm of two minds. On the one hand, ethics are beautiful. They keep us grounded. They keep us at the highest standard of behavior when it comes to our field of practice. On the other hand, they can be limiting and they can prevent us from being on the innovative wave in a way that we really need to.
Yeah, as someone who works in the field of AI, I think absolutely you're hit the nail on the head there in terms of ethics. I want to say ethics are absolutely necessary and important to have, especially when we're developing technology. I think the ethics code that we have as APA psychologists doesn't leave a lot of leeway. And I think it can be very challenging, as you said, when we're looking at fast moving technologies and how do we maintain our ability to help and engage in those without stepping on some of the current ethical codes. I think that's absolutely a critical conversation to have. And I'm glad I'm not the only one who struggles with this. Right. But I think even the fact that you struggle with it, it shows that you're ethically minded and is an important thing to have as a psychologist working in technology. Kayla, this has been so much fun. I'm so impressed with all the great things that you're doing. And anyone who works in technology and psychology is okay with me. So you're welcome back anytime to talk more. But I want to be respectful of your time and say, how do people get a hold of you, Kayla, if they want to continue the conversation or get your services?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn at Dr. Kayla LaLaLaBarge. You can also hit me up via email at kayla.labarge@equilibrialeadership.com. I'll shoot you that contact information too, Ernest, so you can share it if you need to.
Great. And before I let you go, I always want to take advantage of the experts we have on the show and ask, what's a tip or some free advice that you have to share with the audience, especially in this time that we're all in right now?
A good tip. I would say never underestimate the importance of knowing your strengths. Mm. You know, I think they're the foundation of who we are. And if you can just spend time every day taking a few moments to activate the things that make you really, really brilliant, mm-hmm. Not only will you get the dopamine hit that it will provide your brain, but you'll model that authenticity for others to kind of show up and be themselves. So if I could give any advice, is just make sure you're making that time, mm-hmm. Whether or not you're an organization or an individual, to reflect on who you are today, not who you were then, but who you are today and what really matters. So that way at work or at home, you can operate off of those and create bigger meaning from that.
Yeah, I love that advice, especially when you talk about it, not just at the individual level, but the organizational level as well. I think that's really unique. And this all really, you know, really encourages and continues that self-awareness. Continue to know yourself, even as things change around you, and even as you may change, continue to know who you are and what your strengths are. So I think that's such great advice. Kayla, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been so much fun.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And to our guests, thanks for listening. We hope you will join us again next time.